Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush has been talking a lot about freedom lately. In his inaugural address last week, he used the word 27 times. He used it 16 more times in a press conference today. Freedom is the word of the hour, the goal, the means, the motivation, the explanation for Bush policy on many fronts. But freedom, it turns out, can mean different things to different people in different times in different countries. Tonight on Point, freedom, what it means when George Bush says it, what it means to you and to the world. We begin tonight in Washington, where President Bush held a hastily arranged press conference this morning in response to the deadliest day of the Iraq War for American forces. A Marine helicopter crash in western Iraq took 31 lives today, and six more troops died in insurgent attacks. In his opening statement, Bush continued to pound on his theme of freedom, reinforcing the message in his inaugural address last week.
Across the world, freedom has deadly enemies. Yet across the world, freedom has great and growing momentum. There has been enormous sacrifices made by some of our citizens in the spread of freedom. Families suffer as a result of the loss of a loved one. We continue to offer condolences and prayers for those who do suffer. We will honor the memories of their loved ones by completing our missions.
Joining me now is David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. David Sanger, thanks for being with us tonight.
Always good to be back with you, Tom.
So this was a press conference put together in a hurry. Did it appear to be in response to the helicopter crash in Iraq?
No, in fact, I don't think so, because the president had so little to say about the helicopter crash that it had the feel to us of something that they had decided to do maybe the previous night and then had to sort of amend their presentation a little bit, but not much, to take into account this tragic crash.
So if it wasn't damage control on the crash, what was the impetus, the intention of the press conference today?
I think it was to begin to try to lay the groundwork for the election on Sunday in Iraq and to try to put it into a bigger historical frame, which is, as you said in your introduction, sort of the theme of the week for the president and last week as well. At the opening of the press conference, he talked about how this was part of a broader march to democracy. He mentioned the recent elections in the Ukraine, the Palestinian elections, of course, the elections in Afghanistan. So he was trying to make the argument that there was a momentum toward freedom that we have to go encourage, and that was the bigger reason for Iraq. And this is in part a continuation, an acceleration of the transition of rationale for Iraq away from what we heard before we went into the war, when democratization and spreading democracy through the Mideast was the subject of one major speech the president gave, but only one, to the near daily discussion of it now.
David Sanger, you write that the president used the news conference to explain, but your words, not always to reinforce the arguments he made last Thursday in the inaugural address. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you were listening to the inaugural address and you had just arrived here from Mars, you might think that spreading liberty was the number one priority of American foreign policy, and that other nations around the world would be judged on how well they do on that score. And in fact, some smaller nations, or nations with which we are at odds, Iran, North Korea, the outposts of tyranny that Condi Rice talked about in her testimony the other day, could well fit into that category. I asked the president at one point during this interview whether or not he had thoughts on whether this would be the the determinative issue in dealing with China, with Russia, with Saudi Arabia, places with which we have, you know, much broader interests. And he basically said it would be part of it, but not everything, that he thought that we could do many things at one time. I thought that was significant because the signal to the leaders of those nations was your relationship will not depend entirely on this.
David, I have to ask then, you say in some degree the president seemed to be tempering his liberty message, and yet the word freedom is all over this press conference. He referred to it again and again. Is President Bush having it both ways in some sense, or trying to here?
A little bit. I mean, he's described this as a 100-year project, and because he has described it as such, it gives him the freedom, to use the word, I guess, to press the issue where he wants to, and then to declare in those places that remain less free than we would like at the end of his 4 years, that they are part of the longer-term generational or 100-year project.
And if I may ask, what about among the press corps? When the president gives the push for freedom as the justification for policies on many fronts, is that something that the press has difficulty questioning? I mean, how do you contest, as an American, the justification of freedom for a policy?
Nobody can test the objective. The question is, how do you turn it into policy? And that's not a new issue. Jimmy Carter made human rights, you know, the centerpiece of his foreign policy in the late 1970s, and many believe it didn't work out so well. Because in the end, it always bumps up against our more immediate strategic needs. And that's, you know, that's why it is an easy issue to take up and make the dominant issue in relations with, say, Cuba or Burma, and not so easy when you're dealing with an oil supplier like Saudi Arabia or a country critical to the fight against terrorism like Pakistan, where you have to weigh whether it is worth pressing the leader on the treatment of dissidents, holding elections, versus the more immediate things you may need from them.
And finally, David, what about Iraq itself and the future there? Elections coming up on Sunday. What did President Bush have to say about the future of Iraq and how the United States eventually disentangles itself from Iraq?
You know, he didn't talk about disentangling us from Iraq other than to say that we have to reach the point where the Iraqis themselves take on more responsibility for their own defense, but also feel as if they have a government to defend. And I think that this is why the political and the military parts of this go hand in hand, Tom, because it's hard to get the forces to agree to lay down their lives or risk their lives to defend a government that they haven't even seen yet, that they may or may not feel is representative of their needs.
So get the election, the president says, and look for a new generation of Iraqi leaders to step up.
Great theory if it works.
We'll see. David, always great talking with you. Thanks
Good
for being with
to
us
you.
Tonight.
Bye-bye.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. He spoke with me from Washington.
There is only one force of history that can break the reign of hatred and resentment and expose the pretensions of tyrants and reward the hopes of the decent and tolerant, and that is the force of human freedom.
President Bush, with one of his 27 references to freedom in last week's inaugural address, it was impossible to miss. But just what does the president mean and not mean when he speaks of freedom? Our guest tonight, Harvard sociologist Orlando Patterson, hears in President Bush's rhetoric two distinct definitions of freedom, the freedom of the individual and the freedom of the democratic society. There's a lot of room, he says, for misunderstanding here, at home and abroad. Tonight on Point, how George Bush, Americans, and the world use and hear the word freedom. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you understand what George Bush means when he says freedom? Is it the same thing you mean? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard University and author of Freedom in the Making of Western Culture and of a forthcoming book on the meaning of freedom in the United States. His op-ed essay in the New York Times this weekend was headlined, The Speech Misheard Around the World. He's been studying freedom since writing his dissertation on freedom and power in Jamaica in 1967. That's a long time. Orlando Patterson, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to have you as well.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Patterson.
Hi there.
So, Orlando Patterson, you've got a provocative thesis that you're laying out here. Begin to unfold it for us. How do you see President Bush, George W. Bush, using freedom?
Well, I see him using it in two ways, actually. And he's very alert to, or I should say his advisors are very alert to, the varying meanings of freedom. Freedom has got to be seen historically. I mean, like all our values, you know, the way it evolves, and it has various shades of meaning. But I think if I were asked what is central to the concept in the centuries of its evolution, is that it's really about power. As power is central. Power gives it its focus and coherence. It's you're free to the degree that you're not under the power of another person. This is a negative freedom. Mm-hmm. Not another person or another institution, free from constraints. It also has always meant freedom to do things. You're free to the degree that you can do what you want. You can achieve what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that has a dark side, which I can get to in a moment. But it has also, all from the very beginning, meant power sharing. That is to say, you're free to the degree that you belong to a community and you can participate in it and share in the public power, in essence, democracy. Although that can vary in terms of how it actually is realized. So freedom means freedom from power, freedom to exercise power, freedom to share power. Now, what I've argued is that very often those three go together, and in a sense, they need each other. I mean, it's not much point having negative freedom if you can't do anything, freedom to sleep under a bridge. It's not much point having sort of rights officially recognized when, in fact, you don't have a democratic state which will protect those rights, freedom without democracy. So democracy is a part of freedom. Now, what has happened in America, I've argued, is that since the late 19th and early 20th century, there's been a strong emphasis on negative freedom in order to, or freedom from the state in order to achieve positive things. And increasingly, the positive side of freedom, freedom to do things, to do what you want, to do whatever the hell you want to do, the idea of not being fenced in, the idea of realizing one's ambitions, having choices. And
it's coming to dominate the sense of freedom.
It's coming to dominate.
And this is a kind of skinnied down definition
of
freedom. You're
correct.
Saying sloughing off the democratic power sharing side. But you write, and this is pretty provocative. You say the Bush administration's notion of freedom has been especially convenient, and its promotion of it especially cynical.
Yeah.
Cynical. What do you mean by that?
I say it's cynical because in speaking through one side of their mouth, they voice the more sort of, let I say, liberal democratic view of freedom as participation, rights, civil liberties, and so on. But in essence, I mean, the kind of freedom to which they are appealing and which they know their constituency resonates with is the positive freedom of having choices, being able to do what you want, very often protection of property, material choices, and getting your way. And,
the freedom to drive my Hummer and get out of
my
way.
That's correct.
And you've talked to Americans and found that this definition of freedom, that to do what I want, it is growing. I want to come back and look at that. Jack Beattie, I want to get you in on this before the break here. Orlando Patterson says the president's kind of working both sides of the street here, but really leaning toward freedom to do what I will, period.
Yes, and he's playing off something just buried deeply in our political culture. Tocqueville, in his travels in the 30s here, 1830, spoke of, he said he found, quote, the holy cult of freedom among Americans. That Americans were imbued with this notion. Of course, 4 million people were enslaved at the time that they were thinking that. And freedom has undergone many vicissitudes, but in the domestic part, at least, Bush's idea of the ownership society returns to an earlier Republican idea that freedom consists in economic independence, in property, in owning something. And he's trying to convert a social insurance program, which goes into what Dr. Patterson was saying about the third kind of freedom. He's trying to convert that into an investment program so that Americans can be more economically independent. And I think that's the sort of, he mentioned the Homestead Act as a sort of precursor of what he's about. Of course, the Homestead Act only made homes for 400,000 people and was an occasion for an orgy of speculation.
But there's the ideal, go out there and get a chunk of land and do what you will. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about freedom, what it means when George Bush says it, what it means to you and to the world. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about freedom and what it means when George Bush says it, what it means to you, what it means to the world. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you understand what President Bush means when he says freedom? How does the president's definition line up with yours? Are they the same? Are they different? And is freedom just to do as you please, period? Or is it something more than that? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard University, author of Freedom in the Making of Western Culture. You can join us as well. Jack Beatty's here, and we are underway. Orlando Patterson, you write that in your surveys of Americans, that this notion of what you call positive freedom, that is the freedom to do what I want, is really coming to the fore. The others are being left behind. Why is that happening? What are the implications of that? And I think these days you may actually have to convince listeners that freedom is more than that.
Right. As some of the letters I've received after my op-ed clearly indicated, many people said, I agree with you and I'm shocked, but quite a few people said, I agree with you and that's what it should be. One of the most disturbing findings from my surveys and from my hundreds of hours of interviews with Americans is what people do not say when I ask them to talk about freedom. They almost never mention democracy. They almost never mention the sort of civil liberties, the sort of things we normally associate in the formal conception of freedom. And when, of course, I say, but, you know, we've been talking for 2.5, almost 3 hours, and you never once mention voting, democracy, being able to participate in political process. People say, oh, yeah. I mean, of course, I mean, I take that for granted. But what this tells me is that it's not that the object to it or anything, but as far as the mental map of freedom goes, it's just excluded. It's freedom means essentially the power to do things, the ownership to owning things, mobility, and it means choices. And that's often represented.
Mobility, that sounds very much economic.
Economic and physical, actually.
Let's go.
Yeah, when I ask people to tell me the experience they most sort of identify with freedom is driving your car, as well as, of course, socioeconomic mobility. And but also choice in the sense of the shopping mall is a very important sort of embodiment. People go into a shopping mall and have sort of 500 choices in CD.
And they feel free.
Yeah.
So it sounds to me from your survey of Americans that their contemporary understanding of freedom lines up pretty well with what George Bush seems to be emphasizing. It's not all he says, but with what he seems to be emphasizing.
Yes, and this explains a paradox, a mystery. Why is it that over the past 4 years, I mean, there have been persistent criticisms of the violation of civil liberties through the Patriot Act and so on, jailing of journalists, what have you. You'd have thought that Bush would have been shy to mention the word freedom. He has not. In fact, this speech in his inaugural was not the first time. I've tracked all the speeches he's made, and in fact, almost every speech he made in the election referred to freedom. His followers, however, understand this in the way in which I was just explaining to you. It means power, it means choices, it means property. And things like violation of civil liberties and so on is very much sort of outside that mental framework.
But you also write that President Bush understands both definitions,
kind of
both sides of the track, the freedom of the individual, the freedom of a democratic society,
yes.
and that he works both sides of that.
Yep.
You write, the genius of President Bush, your word, is that he has acquired an exquisite grasp of this development in American political culture, and he can play both versions of freedom to his advantage. What do you mean by that?
Well,
when you challenge him, in other words, he'll say, oh, no, I mean civil liberties, civil rights as
yes,
well.
Yes, there are certain occasions where you have to express the more modern liberal view, as in inaugural, as in his discussions with Freedom House or his talk about spreading freedom in the world. And of course, no one would deny that civil liberties are important. But at the same time, I mean, so many of the things he's done have sort of invaded our privacy, have been sort of sharply questioned by not just the American Civil Liberties Union, but even conservatives, libertarians,
mm-hmm.
are very, very concerned. So the point is, how does he get away with it? That's what puzzled me. How does he get away with it?
And the answer is?
And how does he have the nerve after this record to constantly speak about freedom? The answer is, he knows that his followers, in fact, have a conception of freedom for which this is at the most on the back burner or simply not part of the mental map of freedom.
So he's won re-election using it handily. Just fine, thank you. But you say, the headline on your essay, the speech misheard around the world, you say that the danger here is that the world hears the word freedom and they hear hypocrisy. Why?
Why? For two reasons. It's so inconsistent, A, with his policy in his foreign policy, and for those who look more closely, with his domestic policy. As far as his foreign policy goes, he's in the act of promoting freedom at the point of a gun in Iraq.
So you say, but he said, we've thrown out a tyrant, we're bringing elections, Afghanistan has had elections.
In his inaugural speech, whoever wrote it pointed out that freedom has to be chosen. You cannot force freedom on a people because, I mean, if you do that, if you don't have the institutions, if you don't have the will, I mean, as soon as our troops leave, I mean, some mullah is going to take over.
Maybe, but there's no such thing as liberation in that case?
The liberation by someone else can't liberate you. You've got to...
Civil war, a lot of African Americans might feel differently.
Well, you can persuade people. I mean, let me make it clear. I am a great lover of freedom. Nothing would gratify me more than to see all nations of the world free. I come from a very free part of the world. I want to see this as an American foreign policy. I'm saying they've gone about it all the wrong way. We're hated in the world. What, just to mention further hypocrisy, what they see is we're saying that we have an axis of evil and freedom is going to solve the problem there. Yet, in other parts of the world, we seem to be sort of buddies with and chummy with tyrants. I mean, China is a horribly authoritarian regime, yet they are our major trading partners. They see us sort of in bedfellows with Pinochet and so on. So the world looks at that and says, this is ridiculous. The world also looks at our domestic policy and wondered what kind of free society is that, given the violations of the Patriots Act, or just given how our increasingly unequal society. Because for a lot of people in the rest of the world, freedom must mean, to some extent, security. And that seems to be not part of the American vision of what freedom is today.
It was part of FDR's Four Freedoms, of course,
was.
Freedom from Want. But that's maybe a piece of history now. I want to get a caller in. Leo's calling from Salisbury, Massachusetts. Hello, Leo. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Yeah. You have a fabulous show. I think it's really important that we try to consider the people we're going to bring this, quote, freedom to, particularly in reference to the Islamic countries. Is freedom Fallujah, where all that's left standing is a ballot box? Is freedom Abu Ghraib? I mean, what is freedom, and what does it conjure in the minds of the people that we're going to bring this great gift to?
But freedom, you could say it's a vote on Sunday. A vote with all kinds of problems, but the president's pointing to it today, Leo, and says, look, they're going to the ballot.
Is a vote freedom, really?
That's a very good question.
I can't see a vote as freedom.
And is your point, Leo, that the United States cannot bring freedom to other countries, that it shouldn't try?
as it's been discussed in, earlier, you can't force things on people. They need to choose it for themselves. And that certainly their concept of freedom is going to be something outside whether you get to chew some kind of gum or another kind of gum. It's certainly not as narcissistic and shallow as what we consider to be freedom.
Leo, we've got it. Thanks for your call. Ornella Patterson, a vote is not a small occasion. As I mean, this one is flawed and people are being blown up all over the place, I grant you, but still, it's a vote.
No, but, you know, that there's another problem. What is democracy? Democracy is not just voting. I mean, The Economist, a rather conservative journal a few years ago, had a cover story which they referred to phony democracies. Which is
phony.
Phony democracies.
Yeah.
In other words, tyrants around the world have learned the trick of having elections.
Well, sure. Saddam Hussein had elections, and he won 90-something
yes.
percent of the vote.
And as we saw in Ukraine, they tried that. They didn't. It
the first
didn't
time
work.
Out.
First
yeah.
time around. But that's what we have in lots of countries. Just having the vote is not democracy. I mean, you have to have institutions. You've got to have the will of people to vote, and and it's just not there.
And never mind that a lot of people are not voting or will not be voting Sunday for all kinds of reasons. But then maybe behind all that, there's a desire. I want to bring into our conversation, joining us from Stanford, California tonight, Richard Epstein. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago, author of Skepticism and Freedom, A Modern Case for Classic Liberalism. Richard Epstein, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
So Orlando Patterson looks at President Bush's message on freedom, and he says this is another step in skinnying down the concept of freedom, essentially to freedom to do what I want. He says it's a kind of on a starvation diet, this freedom, and it's seen as hypocrisy around the world. How do you see it?
Well, I think that's a bit too overdramatic. I don't think the president is a deep philosopher, and I think what he's trying to do is to use the term in what he regards as the ordinary meanings of most people. And I think most people understand that freedom in one person means that there are correlative duties on others. So the idea that everybody can do what he wants is quickly dismissed and rightly dismissed as anarchy. The question is, what are those correlative duties in private areas? The traditional accounts of freedom say you have to restrain from force and fraud. If you do that, there's nothing about this definition which is peculiarly or exclusively economic. You can have religious freedom, you can have associational freedom, and in fact, the content of your voluntary associations are for you and for nobody else to try to determine. The idea of freedom, I don't think, is the same as the idea of democracy. That's a different axis in which I think the president also believes. And the basic idea there is that with respect to certain kinds of decisions that are collective, we need to have public deliberations because there's no way that we can have one person fight a war in Iraq and somebody else not do that. And that gets into one of the great limitations on the concept of freedom, which is the provision of what we call technically public goods, those things which if you supply to one, you must supply to all. And the classical conceptions, which I support, as the title of the book would suggest, is that freedom exists on such matters as employment and religion and choice, but when it comes to the question of defense budgets and courts and so forth, you have to have collective choices, and when you have collective choices, you have to have participation, and you have to have voting and other kinds of mechanisms. It's hard to obtain these institutions. Orlando is dead right about that.
Let me ask you then, just to sort of lay out what might be another poll, I don't know, do you see, to go way back, FDR's Four Freedoms is still kind of the appropriate emphasis, freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear. Are those operative or are those antique?
It all depends on what the correlative duties are with respect to the situation.
Correlative duties, that's law school speak. What do you mean?
No, actually, it means that either I have a freedom to do X. What does that require other people to do? There's no way you're going to get freedom from want unless you have higher production. And the great tragedy of all the Roosevelt programs is he starts talking about freedom, but in the end, every single program, almost without exception, he created was a monopoly in which you would have agricultural cartels, which essentially lowered output and increased prices. So I think that if you look on the ground, what happened is that the Roosevelt conceptions were to look only at the people who benefited, to ignore the people who were hurt, and then created these huge institutional arrangements, many of which continue to dog us to this very day.
So you're saying good to put American freedom on a diet and shed some of that?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, all of that stuff is completely counterproductive. I mean, why would you want to move heaven and earth in order to create agricultural cartels, which essentially raised the price of food at that time when it really mattered to poor people and made it impossible to get people to move out of the industry on a sort of continuous basis as productivity levels increased?
Stand by for a moment, Richard Epstein, Orlando Patterson. So here's a kind of, Richard Epstein says, yes, I agree with Orlando, but he goes on to sort of push aside a lot of what you're saying here.
Right. That's a wonderful sort of succinct statement of the libertarian position we just heard, and brilliantly done. But the president is not a libertarian.
And the president is not, did you
no,
say?
No, it's not, certainly not. I mean, this is the difference between a libertarian, which sort of emphasizes sort of the negative aspect of freedom and emphasizes...
It is freedom
state,
from power.
From power, including the power of the state messing mm-hmm. around with your private life. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with this president is that he is for a positive freedom which embraces the power to impose my values on you. This administration...
That's kind of the religious right,
George
Bush.
The religious right, the whole culture wars. I mean, you know, what we have here is an administration which has gone out of its way to emphasize the exercise of positive, their notion of freedom on others. And that's very much part of the positive tradition. That is to say, we know what's right for you, and we will impose that on you, too.
Richard Epstein?
I wanted, you know, look, I was only defending the use of the word freedom in the Bush speech. In terms of his specific policy on such things as gay marriage, I'm an implacable opponent of the president because the social conservative agenda, which he embraces in part, is very inconsistent with the libertarian agenda.
But shouldn't we consider the usage in policy of the idea, not just the word in a speech?
I think what happens is, you have to consider it comprehensively, but I think, in effect, what he was talking about in his speech with respect to global significance had little to do with the domestic issues of gay marriage or national security. The national security question is extremely hard for everybody, regardless of what your position is. So I was, you said, you know, which conception am I defending? I do not wish to defend Bush. I did not vote for him. I didn't vote for Kerry. I voted for the libertarian candidate because clearly some of the criticisms that Orlando raises seem to me to have a lot of bite with respect to the president, but I don't.
We've got it. I want to get Jack Beatty in here. Jack, what do you think? Richard Epstein says goodbye to FDR's Four Freedoms, and in a way, good riddance. They didn't work, and he's happy to have the definition skinnied down.
Well, of course, you know, the problem that FDR was reacting to was the collapse of capitalism worldwide and the widespread feeling that it didn't just collapse because it didn't work. It collapsed because of chicanery and manipulation and so on. And the notion of personal freedom had to be augmented by something else. FDR called it industrial freedom. That is to say, workers had to have the right to organize so that they wouldn't have to stand in the labor market, as it were, naked against the power of the great corporation, that finally in American life there'd be a balancing of the scales so that the small person could stand up against the monopolist. And no one in their right mind would contend that somehow the lone individual negotiating with the corporation was free, except the jurist of the 19th century in their liberty of contract theory.
Let me give a couple of numbers. One of the great battles in the 19th century and the early 20th century had to do with maximum hours legislation. And there was a huge progressive move to try to get it down. In a period when all of these statutes were flatly unconstitutional, the number of hours magically worked went from 60 to 50 on average with respect to low-skilled workers. Your theory is you can't explain how that happens. And that's because you misunderstand what competition is about. There is no monopoly on the employer side, nor was any monopoly responsible for the Depression. It was government intervention in the form of the Smoot-Hawley tariff and the massive deflation that was indicated by our friend Hoover.
We got it. We're going to steer away from economic history, but we've got your point, and we understand, yet the Depression stands right there. Richard Epstein, University of Chicago, thank you so much for being with us tonight. We're talking tonight about freedom, what it means when George Bush says it, what it means to you, what it means to the world. Sorry, but our time's a little short here. We got to keep moving. You can join this conversation. Is freedom just to do as you please, period, or is it something more? Is overbearing government the only thing freedom is intended to protect against? And how is George Bush using the word, the idea of freedom? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about freedom, what it means when George Bush says it, what it means to you, what it means to the world. You can join the conversation tonight. When something is done in the name of freedom, can it still be questioned? Should spreading freedom abroad be America's first foreign policy priority? Are civil liberties, political participation, and social justice part of your definition of freedom, or do you prefer a stripped-down version? What is the freedom America stands for? The freedom it should stand for. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard University, author of Freedom in the Making of Western Culture. Jack Beatty's with us as well. And right now, Larry's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Larry. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. I just have two questions that may not even be related.
But yes, sir. Let's hear it.
Talk about, I'd like to hear their comments on the aspect of responsibility and freedom and on how a people's history might influence their views of freedom.
When George Bush calls for freedom, Larry, do you hear him calling for responsibility, personal responsibility?
I hear him calling for people just to, no, not personal responsibility. I hear him calling for, let me do what I want to do because I set you free.
Well, he wants you to be responsible for more of your own retirement, but let us pick those up. Thanks for the questions, Larry. Orlando Patterson, to you. Is responsibility the core of freedom? And secondly, Larry says, what about the histories of different countries and how it leads them or has led them to see, understand freedom?
There was a time when responsibility was an important component of freedom, certainly among our earliest white Americans. The Puritans had this notion of ordered liberty, which stated
ordered
liberty. Sounds like a contradiction, but mm-hmm. what they meant by this is that there's no right without a duty, and that you have a responsibility to the community and to God and so on. So we began our society with that idea, but that mm-hmm. has faded, certainly both in the libertarian view and in the view which prevails in what one may call the followers of George Bush. The idea, the emphasis is on the positive. And the second part of the question is very, very interesting. Does history influence people's views? The answer is yes. And freedom, of course, is one of the oldest values in the West. But just looking at America, one of the paradoxes of America is what happened in the Civil War. The fact that the South went to war on the banner of liberty.
Mm-hmm. In order to keep their slave-owning society.
Exactly. That liberty embraced the right to dominate others.
So how do you explain that conception of
freedom? Well, in a way, the South had history on its side, even though they were wrong within the context of the 19th century and Enlightenment thought, as the Lincoln said, you know, I just can't understand. My view of freedom is different from yours. But mm-hmm. the South had history on its side in the sense that for most of the history of the West, this idea of freedom as power, as the ability to do what you want, including dominating others, women, children, and slaves, was there. And the South held this view. Now, one of the interesting things, it seems to me, it's no accident that the southern part of the country sort of forcefully holds this view still, because while slavery may no longer be acceptable, it's still the idea of freedom is doing what you want, including domination via control of property, via sort of control of corporations or what have you.
Are you saying President Bush is putting forth a kind of southern fried style of freedom here?
Well, it is no accident, as I've said, that from my researches and from the obvious fact that, I mean, the Republican base is in the South, that idea of freedom as power, as doing what you want, is being left the state having little to do with it, is very much at its most forceful expression in the South. And in a way, it's a lingering survival of that. I don't think anyone would explicitly say that it involves dominating and enslaving other people, but it certainly involves telling people how they should live their lives and the faith they should have and whether women control their bodies or not.
Jack Beatty, I've heard you say the abolitionists on the other side of this equation, the abolitionists themselves may have played a part in kind of narrowing the notion of freedom.
Well, they did in this respect. The Republicans, who were founded in the 1850s, defined what they call free labor as against slave labor. The apologists for slavery said, well, you know, you've got wage slaves in the North. And the and Lincoln and the Republicans said, oh, no, no. Yes, we have people who work in factories, but only for a time. They work there for a year or two. They save money. They go into business for themselves. They hire someone else. Or with the Homestead Act, they go out and become farmers. So we don't have wage slaves up here.
We're free.
We're free, and free means economically independent or within reach of that. Well, the abolitionists, on the other hand, would not have any of that. They did not denigrate wage labor at all. In fact, when Frederick Douglass took his first job after slavery in New Bedford, he said, I was my own master. He was working in a factory. He said, I was my own master. They defined freedom as autonomy, as ownership of oneself, and divested it from its economic connection. And in fact, after the war, Garrison and other abolitionists, not Douglass, hung it up. They said, our job is done. African Americans are free, and we've done all we need to do. And the economic condition of African Americans, that was no part of their idea.
So autonomy alone there. Theo's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Theo. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks. Thanks. Sure.
I guess I'm from Indonesia, so I'm from a third world country, and freedom to me means that you can expect to have things that normal people would have. And I think in the context of Iraq, if I could equate that as kind of similar to my country, people need to have maturity and education enough at the level so that freedom can really be sustained.
So when President Bush says that he wants to raise the torch for freedom around the world, are you encouraged by that, Theo, as an Indonesian, a third worlder, in your phrase?
I think I'm a little bit skeptical.
Why?
Because I think to be able to have freedom like Americans are accustomed to here, it will be more like a long process. Because, like I said earlier, I guess I would think people need to be educated first, and also they have all the basic needs fulfilled before they can think about this.
So it sounds like you want freedom, but if it's pushed too fast, you're afraid it's not for real. Theo, thanks for calling. Let's get another caller here. Alan is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Yes, how are you? A couple points. First of all, I just want to correct one thing, that after the Civil War, Americans weren't free, just American men were free. Women were not free until 1918, suffragette movement. But getting to the point, in Iraq, there is voting and there's elections, and the Iraqis seem to be very excited about it, and one-third of the candidates are women. This is very important in the Arab countries to have equal representation of men and women.
One-third by law are women. That's correct. Yeah.
And if this works, and it is a seed that's planted that grows, this could really change the whole dynamic in the Middle East where people have a reasonable discourse. And Dr. Patterson was suggesting that freedom can't be forced on people, but they have to choose it on their own. But how were the Shia in Basra and the Marsh Arabs able to choose freedom when they were all shot and murdered? So, hundreds of thousands of them, mass graves and chemical gases, and the Kurds, these people had they couldn't choose freedom under Saddam Hussein. They had to be deposed.
I hear exactly what you're saying, Alan. What about the fact that there's so much insecurity that people's names can't be on ballots, that people don't know where the polling places are until the last minute? Is that kind of, beside the point in your mind?
Well, you got to start somewhere.
Yep,
you can't just say, okay, well, everybody's got a campaign on the back of pickup trucks. It can't be done that way.
Orlando Pedersen, Alan's raising this point. Are you, Orlando Pedersen, nitpicking? I mean, after all, there's an effort here, as Alan says, a seed.
Yes.
Why not celebrate it?
Well, we've just gone about it the wrong way. I mean, what happens after the troops leave? There are analogs to this. All over what's now called the Third World, during the decolonization, we had democracies, the form of democracies set up. There is voting and so on. within 10 years... almost this is all replaced by tyrants. I mean it's not enough simply to set up voting booths and without the will, without the sort of people themselves being persuaded to do this. And my suspicion is that there's such resentment been fostered by the way we went into Iraq, that the word democracy itself has acquired a bad name.
Well, there's clearly resentment in some quarters, but clearly as well excitement in others. We're going to be hearing from more Iraqis in the next few days as they prepare to go to the polls and go to the polls. Alan, thanks for your call. Miriam's calling from Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Miriam, you're on the air.
Hi, I have a question about the intent of the government with respect to the use of this word freedom. I think as one of your speakers said, freedom is a word that resonates very strongly within the American public, and if the skepticism that Theo spoke about is based, in other words, if there is reason to suspect that the administration is not going in to Iran or Iraq and maybe Iran and these other countries with the intent to, you know, altruistically implement freedom. If we assume that, you know, that is actually not the case, then isn't the question what is the plan of the administration? Aren't they using, you know, they tested the word freedom when they went into Iraq when the, you know, weapons of mass destruction didn't materialize.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, essentially tried out this concept of going in for freedom, and it seemed to be something they could sell. So
it's a big, strong word. How's it being used, Orlando Patterson?
You know, I think there is a deeper objective here on the part of the administration. There's a sense in which the notion of freedom which applies to Americans, as they understand it, may well be what they have in mind in other countries. That is to say, respecting private property, having people having choices, being able to do what they want. Now, in this regard, someone noted to me, several people noted and led us to me after my op-ed, China comes already close to this stripped-down, privatized view of freedom.
That is, I can have my own company, my own factory, I can become rich.
And I respect private property and
yes.
so on.
Mm-hmm.
Democracy, well, that's off the mental map of what freedom is. And
mm-hmm.
so in a strange way, and the same was true of Pinochet's Chile. And so in a way, if something that is similar to what has emerged in China emerges in Iraq, I mean, it may well be that it's very congruent with the notion of freedom, the positive notion of freedom, which is behind the thoughts of many people.
Well, you've noted also that Americans themselves don't exactly participate enormously in democracy. So maybe Americans themselves are letting democracy slip away as essential aspect of freedom.
That's correct. As I said in my interviews, I mean, I'll speak to Americans for hours. And after 2.5 hours, I'll say to them, look, we've been talking for 2.5 hours about freedom. You never once mentioned voting, the right to participate, or anything like that. Then they say, oh, yeah, of course. Then they go on to talk about other things. And so one of the tragic developments in America is the state of our democracy. We have one of the lowest turnout rates in of all the democracies, the advanced democracies. We have a system in which a crisis of incumbency, in which the vast majority of incumbents sort of are reelected.
In the U.S. Congress.
We have a system mm-hmm. corrupted by special interests and by money. It's almost impossible to become a senator unless you're very, very rich or are in the sort of pocket of people who are very rich. And we have also almost a dynastic system emerging in which a disturbingly large number of people in high office are either related to by blood or by marriage to form. So our democracy
take the scales away from your eyes,
right.
And that's what we see.
Now, the interesting thing is, nobody seems to be bothered by this.
Because we're free.
Because we're free, in the positive sense.
Jack Beatty, what do you make? Orlando Patterson writes about the radically privatized view of freedom, but he looks around, doesn't see a whole lot of democracy supporting it.
Yes, freedom, which is a political good, has been turned into a private good. It's been turned into consumerism. The choice in the marketplace, what I can do, my freedom that way, freedom understood politically, that has, I'm afraid, faded badly from the American scene. And in all the ways he manifests it, people don't think of it that way. They don't vote. They don't participate. They assume that we have this shining city on a hill, despite all these anti-democratic practices that he mentioned. So freedom has indeed shrunk for Americans.
May I add one little interesting...
Quickly, our time's short.
...note here. Freedom House, which is, you know, assesses freedom around the world, actually demoted America from a score of 4-3 on its democracy.
Well, I guess then, going forward, we're going to have our eyes wide open on this freedom front. A powerful word and a beautiful ideal. We'll have to watch exactly how it's used. Orlando Patterson, author of Freedom in the Making of Western Culture, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Jack, good as always to have you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation as freely as you like online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.